Okay, this is the continuation of the interview with David Kiefer regarding the Gulf War. And I think we missed a little bit there, so let's recount what happened with the... We were discussing the females in the Army, and you had said that it really didn't have that much bearing on anything.
Yeah. Generally, we had the units that had females that I know of. There was basically no difference between the males and females, maybe a little bit in the other direction. There was probably less problems percentage-wise with females than there were with males. Now, there were a few counts of sexual harassment and stuff like that. There were even some charges of rape and stuff.
Mm.
But that generally didn't happen in units. In fact, if anything, the soldiers were very protective of the women and everything. So, a lot of times went out of the way. I know we had a little bit of problem with the Saudi civilians and their religious beliefs. We had some harassment of some of the females by Saudi soldiers and Saudi civilians, because their outlook on the female is totally different than ours. They look at the female almost as property.
Wow.
So there was a little bit of problem there. But really, it was very minor and isolated, so I didn't see really any problem with our unit. There are a few logistical problems. When we first got to KKMC, we had very limited tentage and stuff. We had 20 to 30 people staying in a 10-person tent.
Mm.
And we were mixed, male and female, at first. We just got there in the middle of the night and set up a tent, and everybody just threw their stuff inside. But the first week to 10 days, we slept very little, at least I did. I probably didn't sleep 10 hours the first 10 days. We were working. Most of the sleep happened when you were sitting in a chair and just not at all.
You're just so busy? Is that what it was?
Yeah. Because, like I said, when we got there, the ground war was getting ready to start. And they said, the morning we got there, we had to go see General Schwarzkopf. I was at the briefing. We briefed General Schwarzkopf on the ammunition mission. And he basically said, I want you back in 3 days and tell me everything's fine. He said, nothing's fine right now with the ammunition. Come back in 3 days and tell me it's fine. So that means you don't sleep any. You work round the clock and go and do the things that had to be done to get everything organized and find out. See, they really had no idea where the ammunition was and how much was in the different locations, and whether that was the right mix to go in those locations. Because that's the type of thing an ammunition group does. Because we know, we can look at the battlefield map where the combat units are, and we know, we have these little tables that tell us what type of ammunition these different units are going to need. And then we ensure that type of ammunition is close by so that it can be resupplied. In wartime, the U.S. military works on a very different type of supply system than we do in peacetime. Excuse me. It's called a push system. You don't wait for the unit to order more ammunition, more food, more anything. You figure out long ago how much he needs if he's involved in combat. By experience, you know you're going to use this X number. For instance, food, if you have 100 soldiers, they're going to need 300 meals a day. They're going to need X number of gallons of water. So the unit's too busy to worry about ordering food. I mean, you're in the middle of combat. So you as a supply person, you ship them the food.
Hmm.
They're going to need it.
So you don't worry for them to order, you just automatically send it.
So it's called a push system. So we did that with the ammunition. As it turned out, they weren't using as much ammunition as the experts had figured, because they just weren't shooting as much. There weren't as many targets to shoot at. Because our weapon systems are made to put out a lot of bullets.
Mm-hmm.
and they just didn't have to use the maximum rate of fire usage. But so that's why we had so much more than we needed.
Was that because technology is so advanced and things, do you think, that we probably because we hit the targets right off rather than having to...
The, for instance, a tank, an M1 tank's ammunition rate, it's based on, number one, it's based on fighting the Russians in Germany, where there's superior numbers, where each American tank has to kill 6 Russian tanks. And that you would average 3 rounds to kill each Russian tank. Well, when we got into combat with, and these are Russian tanks, it was manned by Saudis, Iraqis, we found that, in fact, our equipment was so superior that we were firing further away than the book said we could fire, and we were killing everybody on the first round, with the first round. We were destroying their tanks with the first round. Well, our ammunition tables are based on 3 rounds per tank. So you have 2 extra rounds. Every time you kill a tank, you've got 2 extra. So they were shooting tank rounds at everything because they just had so many.
Just
they were trying to get rid of them. And still, most of the tanks never had to reload. They never, a tank carries around 80 rounds inside the tank. And most of the units we talked to never, never reloaded that tank. They fought the entire war on what they went across the border with.
Wow.
That's how accurate they were. And this is including units that were in some pretty steep combat. I know the impression that the press gave was that it was a cakewalk.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it wasn't a cakewalk to you if you were in a tank firing away for your life, you know, and bullets were hitting your tank.
Yeah.
Tank rounds were hitting your tank. And there were people dying around, including U.S. soldiers. So we had some very intense armor battles where there were tanks sitting, you know, 100 feet away from each other, firing at each other.
Wow.
Fortunately, our armor was so superior that they never penetrated one of our tanks with one of their tanks. Never did. They never killed one of our tanks with one of their tanks.
Incredible.
We killed thousands of their tanks with our tanks.
You mentioned previously, I'm not sure if we got this on the other side or not, about the missile that was deployed. And could you go over that one more time?
Okay. The ATACMS was a very new missile. In fact, it was still secret at that time. It's not actually been included in the U.S. inventory, although we had 100 of them shipped directly from the manufacturer over there. But it's a rocket that goes with the multiple launch rocket system, the MLRS, and there is 1 round per pod, where a normal MLRS pod has 6 rounds. It's a very large missile, and it has anti-personnel and anti-armor bomblets in it. And it's sent up toward a target, and it can detect metal. And when it detects metal, it rains down those bomblets on the target. And in its first use, it was used counter-battery fire against an Iraqi artillery unit that was firing at U.S. troops. This was right before the ground war started. We fired 1 round of ATACMS back at this Iraqi artillery unit. And when the Special Forces team went in to look, there was no survivors and no equipment survived. Totally destroyed. All equipment, all personnel. So that's the type of sophistication. You're talking high dollar values, though. Each of those ATACMS rounds is $750,000.
For one?
For one round.
How many would you say you used?
I think 5 were used. Didn't take very many.
I can imagine.
Now, Patriots were $1.2 million, and we used over 100 of them.
Each?
Yeah, $1.2 million each.
Wow.
And there's 4 rounds on a launcher. You know, if you've seen the picture of the launcher, that's 4 rounds. That's not 1 round.
So they didn't miss very often, would you say?
Well, they sent two up every time, usually, against the Scud, because also contrary to the press reports, the Patriot was not made to shoot down Scud missiles. It's an anti-aircraft weapon.
Oh.
Not an anti-missile weapon. We do not have an anti-missile weapon in the Army inventory. The Navy has some anti-missile weapons, but the Army does not have an anti-missile weapon. And it was kind of adapted to take on that role after it was built. And basically the way they adapted it is they just said, well, we'll send up two per missile. Because what the Patriot was made for was to shoot down nuclear bombers.
Mm.
And the way it does that is it goes up and finds the aircraft, and it explodes in front of the aircraft. And the aircraft flies through the shrapnel, and it takes out the control systems and the motors and all that of the aircraft.
Okay.
So it generally does not hit the aircraft. It isn't designed to hit the aircraft, although in some cases it would hit the Scuds because of the way they fine-tuned the receiver. They actually tricked the thing into thinking that they were further away from the missile than they were to try to get it to hit.
Oh.
But it didn't always hit. And so sometimes you actually saw this on the news reports, the Scud missile that had been shot down, this missile laying there on the ground. Well, that's because that Patriot went off in front of it. The shrapnel punched holes in the missile, and the missile fell to earth because it malfunctioned because of all the holes in it. It didn't actually blow it up.
Would you say that saved a lot of lives? In this?
Yeah, it saved my life. I had one coming right down on top of me.
Really?
We could see it. We could see it coming right at us. And, I mean, you know, it was obvious.
Wow.
It was coming at us.
So what do you do at a time like that? What goes through your mind?
It happens too fast, because it was like, you know, it's like watching fireworks. You're going, ooh, ah. You know, because we had a Patriot battery right next to us. Like,
uh-huh.
200 or 300 yards away from us, we had a Patriot launcher set up.
Do you think that's what they were aiming for, was maybe that?
You can't really call what they did aiming. it was like, you know, you have this map of the Middle East, and they went, let's shoot it that way. It was very inaccurate, because they had no idea we were where we were.
Yeah.
I mean, they knew King Claude Military City was there.
Mm-hmm.
We were, like I said, 26 miles south of King Claude Military City. Our ammunition site was, and we knew it was secure enough that he didn't know it was there.
Hmm.
And it just so happened that we had a missile coming right at us. I mean, right at us, you know, we're talking 24 square miles, so that's what I mean by right
at us.
That's
close enough.
But when you're standing there, and it's coming down, and you see the front of the missile,
yeah,
you know, and you see the fire coming out of the back of it and all that, that's close enough.
You're really
for me.
So needless to say, you were thankful for the Patriots then, weren't you?
We have pieces of the Patriot, I mean the Scud.
Ah.
In my armory, we have pieces of it mounted on the wall. That's how close it came to us. But we had pieces 3 feet long in our compound after the thing was over.
Hmm.
So you can imagine what a 3-foot piece of metal falling from the sky would do to you.
Really?
It destroyed one of our vehicles and shredded some tents and stuff.
That's all right. You can live with that. You
know? We were in the bunker by the time the stuff fell, but we were standing outside when the Patriot got us.
So back home, your wife is, how's she doing?
Oh, pretty good. She did a lot better than I think she thought she would do. But like I said, we had foster children. So she was dealing with all that. In fact, there were 4 new foster children by the time I got back home.
Oh.
And there were some that I never saw. So she was continually getting the turnover and everything. And dealing with things like the bills and which she doesn't normally deal with, and just the house.
Yeah.
She'd never cut grass in her life before, and all of a sudden it came springtime and the grass started growing, and she had to figure out how to start the lawnmower and how to cut the grass. But she did it.